Bees provide us with every third bite of food we eat. Furthermore, they are the canaries in the mine of our environment. As goes the bee, so go we. And so today we pause to look into their cage and ask, is the bee thriving or dying?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,156th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in St. Petersport who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, about that canary in the cage. There was a time when hard rock miners carried caged canaries down into their mines as a safeguard against invisible accumulations of methane and carbon monoxide gases. Canaries are very sensitive critters, much more sensitive than hard rock miners, and so when the toxic gases did begin to accumulate way down there in the deep dark mine, the poor little canary would die. Seeing that poor little bird dead in the cage, miners would skate back to the surface before the accumulation of gases became so great it killed them. And so that canary in the cage became a metaphor for an advanced warning of danger. Another advanced warner of danger is the bee, which, like the canary, is very sensitive to environmental toxicities. But the bee also serves another purpose. You see, the bee is our miner of the environment, and by its mining of pollen, brings to us one out of every three bites of food. Wow. In a very real sense, as goes the bee, so go we. And so today we pause to ask, is the bee thriving or dying? And who better to ask than fellow Viking and award-winning nature writer, Thor Hansen, author of Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. Welcome back to the Food Chain, Thor.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Michael. It's a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. So you're up there in the Pacific Northwest, where every writer dreams of being, off there in the woods, writing away in a rustic little cabin someplace, right?
That's more or less the story. Yes, we're lucky enough to be out here in the woods.
Good for you. Well, and as a person who lives in the woods, you're acutely aware of nature and living in it as close to it as you do, and you have become a nature writer, author of Feathers, The Impenetrable Forest, The Triumph of Seeds, and now Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. So before I received the notification of your brand new book, I walk the dogs a lot through a field of clover, which of course means there's a lot of bees, if we're lucky, and there were a lot of bees. And they capture my attention. You know, first, of course, I wonder if they're going to sting me, but they never do. But I get to watch down there and imagine what they see as they're buzzing around that clover and how industrious they are. And I can even smell the great accumulation of pollen that they've captured in their on their bodies as they take it back to their hives. And I just kind of fall in love with their lives and how industrious and wonderful their being is. But you must have had some kind of epiphany moment when you decided, gosh, that's my next book, Bees.
Yes, well, my interest in bees really dates back to some graduate work I was doing down in Central America, and I was studying the pollen dispersal of big rainforest trees. I had gone out and genetically fingerprinted every adult tree of a particular species across this stretch of landscape, and so I could see in the genetic data that I'd gathered that something was moving pollen among those trees, but not just between neighboring trees, between trees that were as much as a mile and a half apart. And because the trees were in the pea family and had these big purple pea flowers, just like the sweet peas or garden peas in your backyard, I knew that something had to be bees. So I spent a fruitless couple of weeks with an entomologist friend, and we had a field assistant who was handy with a crossbow, and we were shooting lines up into the canopy and hauling up all these traps. And we caught nothing. We hardly caught anything at all, and we never learned what species of bees was doing that work. But the mystery of it sparked a fascination within me that simply wouldn't rest. And I've been looking for ways to chase after bees in my work and also just in daily life ever since. So it was very much a natural for me to choose bees as a topic for a book.
And there you are. So, you know, so something I always wanted to ask a nature writer, which is kind of an aside, if you will. It seems to me like the taking of pictures of nature, you know, it's one thing to get a picture of the beauty of nature, and that's fine. But when you put a person in that picture, it's much more interesting. And you almost immediately start looking for a story when you see a person in that picture of nature. And when exactly did human beings come into the picture of bees?
Ah, yes, this is such a great question. And I think you're right. I think we do identify, we're interested in nature, but we're also very interested in
ourselves, right? We're mostly interested in ourselves.
Yeah, people like people. It's natural. It's natural to do so. And what's fascinating, really, with our relationship with bees is to think of how deep it really goes. You know, we know that people have kept domestic bees since at least the Middle Kingdom of Egypt, when there's good evidence of Egyptian beekeepers moving their hives up and down the Nile in time with seasonal crops and wildflowers. But for some people who are studying this, they believe that our relationship with bees shouldn't be measured in the thousands of years. It should be measured in the millions of years. And the reason for that is some quite wonderful new research done by a group of anthropologists, nutritional anthropologists, who have been working with the Hadza people of Tanzania, a group that still subsists in a hunter-gatherer lifestyle, in the very landscape where our species is thought to have evolved.
Oh, where the Leakey family was running around digging up...
Absolutely.
Yeah,
same
there you go.
Neck of the woods as the Leakey family, Olduvai Gorge, that whole dry, hot region of Tanzania. And these people make a living there by gathering and by hunting and by hunting honey. And that's well known that people gather honey from wild hives.
Mm-hmm. People and bears.
People and bears, too. It's a wonderful, rich food resource. But what these folks did was try to assess how much honey the Hadza were eating, and what they found was remarkable. It wasn't just an occasional treat. It's something that people look for every single day. And if you add it all up, honey is providing 15% of their diet on an annual basis, and that's a number that's far higher during certain times of year when it's particularly prolific, and higher even for men who tend to do most of the honey hunting and who eat a lot of the honey out in the field before they even get back to camp. So it's a major part of the diet. And that's interesting in its own right, but it's powerful when you think in terms of human evolution, because the story of human evolution has always been the story about brain size. And the brain is what physiologists like to call metabolically expensive. It takes a lot of energy to have a big brain, and every increase in brain size in human history, people theorize, has been accompanied by some increase in calories through hunting and improvements in hunting techniques, or through cooking and the better nutrition you get from cooked food. Or now people are starting to think, well, what about honey? Because all of those innovations that have been associated with hunting and cooking could also benefit honey hunters in that stone tools allow one to chop into the hidden nests within trees that provide huge amounts of honey. And the use of fire not only is good for cooking, but also gives you the ability to pacify honeybees with smoke.
Control.
The control of it and the sugary boost of calories that would be accompanied by those advancements is just the sort of caloric boost historically associated with increase in brain size. So people now believe that it's possible our primordial sweet tooth helped lead us to bees and to honey, providing the calories, or some of the calories, that helped make us who we are.
Well, that's pretty darn fascinating. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about where that primordial sweet tooth took us and our bees through civilization. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with fellow Viking Thor Hansen up there in the Great Pacific Northwest, and you. When we come back, bees. Where on earth would we be without them? Do stay tuned.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it, it's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Thriving or dying? That's the question on the table today. And we're talking, of course, about bees. Are they thriving or are they dying? They are the canaries in the mine of our environment. And as go the bees, so go we. Well, really quickly, Thor Hansen, you looked at the situation with respect to the bees. Over the course of millions of years, and how does it look today? Are the bees thriving or are they dying?
Well, like many people who are interested in bees, I've been shocked, really, and alarmed by the headlines over the past few years about bee declines and the challenges that they face.
It's been a number of years, too, haven't we? That, you know, we've come to the conclusion that there's something wrong with the bees.
Yeah, well, the story that really caught public attention and scientific attention, I should say, was in 2006 with the advent of something called colony collapse disorder. And this was a situation where commercial beekeepers first noticed it. They started losing massive numbers of hives that would simply empty of bees. The bees would fly off as if they were going to forage and would never return.
Would that leave the honey, would that leave the queen and her attendants in the hives, or would the hive be completely empty?
So what they would find when they opened up these quiet hives were a few disoriented hive bees and some dying, you know, and a dying untended queen.
Wow.
Because the hive had just emptied. And this happened, you know, some beekeepers were losing 80-90% of their stock in the beginning of this crisis. And then it started showing up in Europe as well, North America and Europe. And the silver lining, if there is one to such a crisis, is that it spurred a huge surge in research. And people began trying to figure out what was going on with the honeybees, but then also broadening that focus to look at native bees as well, the bumblebees, the leafcutter bees, the mason bees, sweat bees.
How many species of bees?
So we're talking about an estimated 20,000 species of bees in the world, more species than all of the birds and the mammals put together and then some.
Wow. So that would be that would really be indicative, though, of its significance in our environment, wouldn't it? Just the number of the species alone.
Absolutely. Yeah, that great diversity, which came about really through their coevolution, if you will, coevolution with the flowering plants. Bees arose 120 million years ago or so, right at the time, that period of time when flowering plants were beginning to spread and diversify. And there was real coevolution with increase in diversity on both sides of the equation. As the plants adapted their flowers and in ways to try to attract bees for pollination purposes, and as the bees focused in on these flowers and developed long tongues for sucking nectar and developed branched fuzzy hairs for carrying pollen, all of those things, that interaction, that back and forth, led to great success for both groups.
And that really started about 120,000 years ago, you said?
120 million.
A million.
So this occurred back in the era when the dinosaurs were still lumbering around. Yes. And so it's an ancient group that evolved from the wasps. Wasps are older still. Wasps had been around for millions of years.
So it went from being a meat eater to a vegetarian.
I was just about to say it. Yes, you're right. It was a dietary switch, really, that led the bees on their own evolutionary pathway. And that dietary switch was giving up meat. It was giving up the hunting and scavenging of protein for their own purposes and for feeding their offspring, and transferring over to this new resource, really, on the landscape, this new and growing resource that was provided solely by the blossoms of flowers.
So went from being that predatory meat eater to being the foraging vegetarian, then.
Yes, you can think of them really as hippie wasps.
There you go.
Long-haired, flower-loving vegetarians.
And when did we start really picking up on the bee and using it as a tool of agriculture?
Yes. So if you think about our long history, deep into prehistory, really, with gathering honey from the wild and being associated with bees, it's not surprising that we domesticated them, before we did horses or camels or ducks, before we domesticated crops like oats or even coffee. We domesticated bees very early on, perhaps 5,000 years ago. And their association with agriculture only became really clear to us much more recently, in that we didn't understand insect pollination.
Nobody taught us about the birds and the bees, right?
There was something very much missing from that equation. You know, it was very well known, even by Aristotle, that bees were closely associated with flowers. And Aristotle was a beekeeper and was very interested in bee behavior, but that crucial link of pollination wasn't fully understood until the 19th century. Since that time, we have come to rely particularly upon honeybees and the domestic honeybees for a huge amount of pollination services, in that the way we farm today with very efficient but very limited diversity on many farms where we have monocultures or one crop grown over huge acreages and very efficiently from road edge to road edge. That whole field is plowed and farmed. And, you know, there's very little habitat in many cases outside of that cultivated space for bees and for the flowering plants that support bees outside of the brief period where that one crop is in flower. And so because of that, we have come to rely more and more on domesticated honeybees for pollination and trucking bees around from place to place when crops come into bloom.
Is there something about the European honeybee that makes it more domesticatable than other bees?
Oh, really good question. So the domestic bee that we have is indeed a European species and not native to North America. In fact, you know, one of the reasons I knew we needed a book with more information on bees is when I was driving in my car once and I heard a very noted historian of science talking about how the early colonists arriving at Plymouth and Jamestown brought honeybees with them from Europe, which is true. But then he went on to say that if they hadn't, there would have been nothing in North America to pollinate their crops.
Oh.
I almost drove off the road because, of course, you know, we have 4,000 species of native bees already buzzing happily around this continent. But the domesticated bees, the European subspecies of the honeybee, which is a native species from southern Europe to the Near East all the way down through Africa, is a fairly calm subspecies as honeybees go, and has been domesticated and bred for docility, you know, over thousands of years now. And so it is the easiest among the honeybees to keep.
Which is why I can walk through a field of clover and see a million bees down there buzzing around the ground among the clover. And somehow they look up at me and seeing this big giant with his animals running through their clover, and they all just seem to be, I'll just move over a little bit, let this giant walk by, and go about my business. Nobody ever seems to get upset, and I guess that's part of the docility you're talking about.
Sure, yeah, for honeybees, and then also for all the native bees in your clover field as well, the bumblebees and others. You know, the defense reaction of stinging really is associated with defending more than it is associated with attacking. And so unless they feel threatened or are trapped or are right near a hive or a nest that's worthy of defending, you're very unlikely to be stung.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Thor Hansen, author of Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. When we come back, I'd like to take Thor out into the fields of agriculture and explore what he thinks is going wrong that we're having such trouble with the bees. This is the Food Chain. Do stay tuned. We will be right back with the buzz of bees.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
They are the canaries in our mine of our environment, those honeybees, those bees, all the bees, all 20,000 species of bees. Without them, we'd be in pretty big trouble because they do make possible one out of every three bites of food we eat and tends to be the real delicious kinds of food that we eat as well. You know, you made a construction in Buzz in which you took apart a McDonald's Big Mac. Would you do so to let the folks know just exactly how significant bees are, Thor?
Yeah, so I wanted to look for bees and the influence of bees in an unexpected place, an unexpected meal, if you will. I mean, if you walk into a farmer's market or the produce aisle at the grocery store, the influence of bees is very apparent. I mean, you look around and you see all of these fruits and nuts and vegetables, and you think, gosh, if these things weren't being pollinated, I'd have a lot less to choose from here. That's sort of intuitive. But I wondered, well, what about a Big Mac? You don't walk into McDonald's and think about bees. What would be left if you took the bees out of the equation, all the ingredients that require bee pollination in some fashion? What would you be left with, you know, with that hamburger? And one thing I can tell you is that famous advertising jingle of, you know, two all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun, it never would have caught on in a world without bees, because the whole jingle would have been two all-beef patties, bun.
And that's all, right?
Yeah, all the other things in that advertising jingle that make the burger so interesting to eat and flavorful rely in some fashion on bees, whether it's the cucumbers that need to be pollinated to make your pickle slices, or the iceberg lettuce, which was developed as a kind of lettuce. You know, of course, you're just eating the leaves, but that variety of lettuce was developed by a famous plant breeder named W. Atlas Burpee, Burpee Seed Company, in an open bee-pollinated trial on his farm, you know, over 100 years ago. So the lettuce has to go.
Yes, and of course, the tomato.
Yeah, you can't have tomatoes, you can't even have special sauce because of the bee-pollinated paprika or the vegetable oils that make it creamy.
The mustard.
Yeah, all of these things on a burger that you need to scrape off. And even to the point of picking off every, with all 243 sesame seeds came off the top, because that, even though sesame can self-pollinate, that is from a bee, was derived from a bee-pollinated plant.
So without the bees, our life would be pretty dull. And not just that, but not just what we eat, but all the plants around us. Where would they go? How would they get along in the world too without the bee? So hugely significant. Something's going wrong. Some say, what is it? 40% of the 20,000 species of bees on Earth are endangered or going extinct. What the heck is going on, Thor Hansen?
Yeah, so that it's an alarming figure that, you know, a large proportion of our bees are thought to be in decline. And we don't have firm data on a lot of them, in that, you know, only a small fraction of our 20,000 species have ever been studied in detail. But many of the ones that have been looked at, you know, are dwindling in some fashion. And so, as I mentioned earlier, the silver lining to colony collapse was how much research attention has now been focused on bees. And one thing really is certain after all this work, and that is that it's more than one thing. There is no smoking gun, no single factor that is responsible for bee declines. What we really see is an overall crisis in bee health, and it is something that many experts are coming to call now multiple stress disorder. And four of the key stressors that bee research talk about, they summarize as the four Ps, being parasites, pathogens, pesticides, and what they call poor nutrition. And, you know, poor nutrition being the lack of flowers, as we've talked about in some of these agricultural landscapes, which are very efficiently farmed but don't have much habitat now for bees. The pesticides, including things like the neonicotinoid class of pesticides, which are very common and which are what they call systemic pesticides, meaning the poison, the toxin is throughout the plant itself, meaning it ends up in the nectar and pollen. And even if it's not fatal to bees in smaller doses, it can diminish bee health or affect some of their ability to remember or navigate, those sorts of things. So what you see is this whole network, really, of interacting factors, any one of which might not be serious for bees, but in concert, they can really diminish the bees' ability to thrive and survive.
Well, it seems like two of these Ps, parasites and pathogens, are just a consequence of being in nature, in the competition involved between one species and another. That's just the nature of things, correct? But the other two things, pesticides and poor, I guess just the fact that there's just one crop out there, the lack of diversity, that's people stuff. That's us.
Yes. So you have, you know, many of these things are things that we have done, you know, to our own management of our environment, and in doing so, exacerbated some of these other factors that, as you say, may have been natural. For example, there are many, you know, just as we suffer from a wide range of viruses and bacterial infections, well, so do the bees. But when bees are weakened by these other factors, some virus that they might normally carry without symptoms even can become far more serious or even deadly. And so we see this interaction of all of these factors having a cumulative effect on bees. And the good news is that we do know enough to take action. We may not understand or be able to tease apart the precise cause of every bee decline for any individual species, but we know enough to do things that can help all bees, right?
You know, a quick aside, in the shows I have done on bees, one of them struck me as particularly interesting, and that was the urban bee, and how the urban bee seemed to be thriving at a time when the country bee is having such great difficulty. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, that gets very much to this idea of what can be done.
And oh, that. Well, you got to hold on to that then, because we have to take a break here, and we don't want to go there until we get back from this. But even before we do, I'd like to ask you how bees are trucked from one place to another, and the impact of that on a hive, because it's so fascinating that bees from Florida can be shipped to California all the way across the country to do a specific job. How on earth can anything survive in that kind of environment, especially when they're as delicate as a little tiny bee? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Thor Hansen and you. When we come back, how do we keep the bees alive and us too while we're at it? Do stay tuned.
And now, more of What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And we're back. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson, and I'm talking about those bees and how they're trucked clear across the country. Thor, how does that work?
So bees and the honeybees will go back into their hives at dark, you know, and spend the night. And so when bees need to be moved from place to place, these commercial beekeepers will load them all up onto a flatbed semi-truck. So you might have several hundred hives loaded onto the back of a semi and driven through the night, and then stopped someplace during the day. Since the bees will want to come out and forage, or they can be fed with sugar water to keep them going. And in this way, you can transport bees over huge distances and have them arrive at a crop right when it begins to flower, which is, you know, brilliant management, but very, as you say, very stressful on the bees. And it also contributes to what we were talking about in terms of poor nutrition. Not only are they getting inundated with one particular sort of nectar and pollen, the only thing in the landscape that is available to them, but then they might just be kept alive on sugar water for these long journeys, and they have to deal with the stress of all of that dislocation and movement. So it is true. I mean, it's remarkable that we can do these things, and beekeepers are remarkably skilled at caring for bees and keeping them alive through all of this. But it is a stress on them. And again, when you start to diminish health in one aspect, the bees become more susceptible to the pathogens or the parasites or the other things that they encounter.
So it's like feeding them sugar frosted flakes and expecting them to stand up to the stresses of the world. Doesn't work for very long, right?
Right, right. You can keep bees going on sugar water and supplements and things, but what they have really evolved to eat is a variety of nectar and pollen from the mixed plants in nature for honeybees. There are some of those other 20,000 species that are in fact specialists on one particular type of flower, but for honeybees and bumblebees and some of these generalist feeders, they expect a varied diet, and in many cases they're just not getting it.
Just like us. Want to go to the restaurant and have a choice, right?
Yes,
absolutely. So how do we come to grips with the fact that, one, we need to do something, and two, what do we do?
Well, you mentioned earlier this interesting trend where urban bees in some places are thriving, and there have been several studies of this now. One that comes to mind was an interesting study of diversity of bees and abundance on a sort of a transect, if you will, running from the agricultural areas outside the city of London all the way in through the suburbs and into the heart of the city. And they found, in fact, that there was greater abundance and diversity when they started hitting the suburbs and into these neighborhoods where people had backyard gardens with a variety of flowers, and some gardens were unkept and had places for bees to nest, and there was open ground here and there and cracks in pavement, and you know, all sorts of habitat really for bees that no longer existed out in what we think of as the more natural setting of the countryside. And so you saw greater diversity in those settings, which underscores really what we can do to help, and that is, you know, to plant more flowers and provide more nesting habitat, which you can do anywhere. You can do it in your yard, you can do it in a window box in an apartment, and you can also start doing it back out in agricultural landscapes. And we do see a trend now, small but growing, of farmers and growers beginning to plant hedgerows again that provide bee habitat and really increase the diversity of bees on their farms, because it's a benefit to them as well as to the diversity of all sorts of things on their farm, and pollination and everything that goes along with it.
Wow. And then, so there we are. How do we come to grips with it? It seems like agriculture is coming to grips with this. Hard for city people to imagine the countryside as being not so natural. But it isn't anymore. I recall interviewing a farmer in South Dakota and sitting in his living room looking out over his fields, and there was like 10,000 acres of corn. That was it.
Yeah.
So it's not a natural environment for anything anymore, and far from natural for the bees. So agriculture, though, is coming to grips with the fact that maybe it's wise to plant hedgerows and some flowers and whatnot now, and maybe that'll change a little bit. But will it be enough?
Will it be enough? That we don't know yet, of course, but there are signs that bees respond well to these restoration efforts, in that you can see bee diversity and abundance triple in an almond orchard in a single season after you plant a native hedgerow. And, you know, so there is some encouraging news out there, but you're right, there's a huge transformation that we would have to go through to really improve the vast majority of farmlands for bees, make it healthier for bees, because we should reduce pesticide use as well. That's another thing that is very clear, that you can reduce stress on bees by reducing pesticides and managing how they're applied.
So it's almost as if to save the bees, we somehow have to put people back on the land, because all of those pesticides and those herbicides and whatnot were designed for the specific purpose of getting people off the land and moving them into town. And so that's kind of a frightening prospect. You mean I might have to go back to hoeing weeds?
Well, it makes for an interesting question. You know, will the farms of the future look more like farms of the past? We don't know, but if you want bees on the landscape...
Hold that right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Okay, so we have just a few minutes left. Want to ask our guest today, Thor Hansen, fellow Viking up there in the Pacific Northwest, how can people get into the world of bees? I mean, most of us live in the city and we see an occasional bee fly by and don't think much about it, but how can we go about getting into their world and just learning to love them?
Yeah, well, I wrote the book precisely to help people learn the basics about bees and learn that, in fact, they are so diverse and fascinating. And my hope is not simply to make people enthusiastic, but to inspire people to get out and see bees, which you can do in so many different ways, by simply sitting down and observing a bee on a flower, and by planting flowers in your own space, whether it is a window box or in a city, or whether you have the ability to participate in a bee garden at the nearest park or school, or whether you have a backyard where you can do plantings that encourage bees. It's as simple as getting some clover into your lawn or letting the dandelions flower. And when you do so, you start to see, in fact, that there is probably quite a diversity of bees wherever you live. Mm-hmm. And you can do things then to help them by providing more flowers and by providing nesting habitat.
How old is your son?
My son is 8 years old.
8 years old. Kate, how did you introduce him to bees?
Well, I think that children have a natural interest in the outdoors and a curiosity about natural history and a special affinity for bees, in that because bees provide sweetness to our ancestors in the form of honey or even in the little treats in solitary bee nests, I think kids have always, until the advent of refined sugar and cheap candy, known how to find bees on a landscape. So I feel like kids are innately interested in bees, and it was no trouble at all to get my son and any of his friends who will come along with us to go out looking at bees and catching them and identifying them and releasing them.
Did you ever teach your son how to rob the nest, how to rob a beehive?
We have had fruitless experiences trying to get native bumblebees to nest in the various boxes and contraptions and empty boots and teapots that we've put out for them, hoping that if we can get a good bumblebee nest going, a thriving nest, that the bees wouldn't mind if we taste a little bit of their honey. So that's a project that is still very much in process.
Okay, so quick one last question. You've worked on a number of different subjects with respect to nature. What's next?
Well, I'm writing a book right now about the natural history of climate change.
Ooh.
So not about the process itself, which has been very well covered, but about how plants and animals, including things like bees, respond to change and how we can measure adaptation and even evolution in real time in the plants and animals around us.
Kind of like looking at the tree rings in a redwood tree.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, watching carefully and all of the great research going on right now to understand how creatures and plants are adapting or not to the rapid changes that we're thrusting upon them.
Thor Hansen, thank you so much for joining us. Are bees thriving or dying? What do you think out there? Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Thank you, Thor.
Thanks very much, Michael. A pleasure as always.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.